This is Eve Silber. I'm here in Flatbush. I'm with Jose LaSalle, Fatima Shakur, and Chris Brown.
Thank you.
You guys have been spending a lot of time on this block. This is the vigil for Kiki Gray that's been ongoing. This is 2 weeks tonight, this action. How did this start?
Well, at first I see the news clipping of Kamani Gray on the news, and something didn't sit right with me. You know, from my first understanding that a child lost their life, I didn't have no idea what happened until I came out here. So I just immediately came out here and started speaking to people from the community, you know, finding out what had happened. And the first report I got, it was that Kamani Gray peed Justice's pants, supposedly walking away from a scene, and the police just jumped out the car and started shooting. And I got attached to the story because he was a child. And I believe that, you know, the police, you know, attempts to fabricate things and when it seemed like, you know, we're wrong. And I had to come out here to find out what really happened. And, you know, he didn't do anything wrong.
So you felt that you smelled the injustice of it all right away.
I smelled it.
And
I
you felt that it. You had to come. And you're an experienced activist and a community organizer, not necessarily right in this community, but in a very nearby community.
I'm an activist and I speak out on any injustice that I see, especially police brutality, because I'm a victim of police brutality myself. But before my situation, I've been, you know, very active on police brutality because, you know, they're doing too much.
Right.
You know, every year, 21 deaths last year with NYPD, you sit in your house and you have to leave because enough is enough, you know, Molly Graham.
And Jose, you've been on the ground here on this action. Our audience needs to understand that every single night since his death, there's been a vigil here, hasn't there?
Yes, we decided the Stop and Frisk Freedom Fighter.
That's the group you're associated with and
that's
created?
That's the group that I created, yeah, and Fatima Shakur. We kind of consider ourselves first responder when somebody get killed. We've been doing that all the way from the Ramali Graham all the way down to the Ronaldo Cueva, Noel Polanco, Whirlwind Jackson. I mean, I could name so many. So we first respond to all that. So as soon as we got that information, I sent two of my girls out here who met with Fatima Shakur, and they was they put the rally together and they try to, you know, saying make sure that the people get involved and understand that this is an incident that we need to talk about, especially knowing that there was a 16-year-old young man there named Kamani Gray.
And Chris, I know you through the Occupy movement.
Uh-huh.
You are a Brooklyn resident as well, and you've been here on the ground many of these nights.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see going on here?
I mean, I've seen sort of an evolution of things going on here. I came down here with my wife, Pamela, I think it was Thursday after the shooting. So I didn't come down immediately, but I came down that Thursday and you know, I immediately saw there was still a large crowd down here on that particular day. As a matter of fact, there was a march that day. And we started marching towards the precinct that night. And it was sort of a division in the crowd on that night. And some people were sort of being directed into this meeting that was going on in the church. And others chose to continue to march down to the precinct. Pam and I ducked into the church with the meeting, sat and listened. And sort of very quickly, I realized that there was this divide going on. There was sort of like this conversation about insider-outsider, which concerned me and Pam and most of us, I think, immediately.
Is that conversation still going on?
I mean, it's still going on in the periphery in a sort of way, but I've been referring to it as a straw dog or a straw man.
Right.
It's not a true argument or even a true legitimate conversation in a sense.
And yet it was the bulk of what the media had to talk about in those days.
Doesn't surprise me.
What would you guys say the media should have been talking about when it was talking about that?
Well, really, there was no media out here. That Sunday night I came out here and I was just pulling the situation out. That Monday I came back and I started talking and I, you know, came to the corner and there was no police out here. There was no media. There was Jewish streamers here, but no mainstream media until after the so-called riot, you know. And the first initial story that was put out by the mainstream media is that a criminal was killed, you know, that he had a gun. And he was just wrong. So a lot of people couldn't identify with the situation because they didn't know the truth. You know, the mainstream media doesn't tell you the whole story.
Sure.
So people already was see Kamani as a criminal that had a gun. He deserved everything that got with him until, you know, people came out and started talking to the community. Like,
people came out in response to those statements,
negative comments. People know that you can't believe what the police say. You know, the community say that there was no gun. So we have to believe what the community say before you believe what the police, because they change a lot of information. So...
But the presence on Wednesday night and the crowds, you think, came from the fact that they were really mischaracterizing this kid.
Yeah,
and totally. That there were so many people who loved and knew this kid in the community that they showed up.
Yeah.
Enraged not only for his murder, but for what the police were in follow-up saying.
Yeah, and it was destroying his character, you know?
Do you think you've gotten the message through about who Kiki really is?
Well, yeah, the whole situation is the reason why we respond to a situation like this as quick as possibly as we can is because we want people to understand that what you're going to hear come out through the news, media, the first thing you're going to hear is going to be the negative things about it, that we need to make sure that we keep it, you know, we keep people's minds open to understand that we have to continue to push forward until the truth come out. And if people, so-called outsiders and the community, did not get together, we would have never known about these officers having a 5-on lawsuit for police brutality.
So while the community was in mourning, these so-called outsiders were able to connect some of these dots about who these officers were.
Correct.
You see that as a function of outsiders in a time like this?
I think it's very important for us to realize that, you know, there's no such thing as outsiders, but we're using that because since Jermoni Williams threw that out there through the news, which I cut him off on it too. So, you know, we riding with that because the simple fact is that it is important for other communities to see that communities outside of their own community is willing to come out of their comfort zone to support and to fight against injustice that exists everywhere. So that's important for people to see that, you know, people is willing to unite.
It is the media that is characterizing people as outsiders more than the people who are here.
I'd say it was the media and the politicians and some of the clergy as well. And, you know, there really is no outside here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the human community, really. And I like to ask people, so where do you draw the line? Cortelyou, Flatbush, Stryker, where do you draw the line?
Yeah.
And one of the beautiful things about people who do come from outside of Flatbush, let's say from other neighborhoods and communities, is the resources we bring here as well. The things we've learned through Occupy, through other movements, Stop, Stop, and Frisk, Freedom Fighters. Fatima has been involved with a lot of actions for justice. And we bring those resources with us to contribute to the community.
Let's talk about those resources. What resources are being used here? And maybe you can even tell me if you think they've been used here for the first time.
I think we're resources where Latin people know their rights. We advocate for that because a lot of people don't know their rights.
So you're organizing right now to make sure that that information gets made available.
Doing some patrols, community patrols, to let people know how to deal with the police when you encounter them, and also to know, let the community know, don't be afraid of the people that are coming out here, because, you know, we got this label of being agitators due to Councilman Jermoni, because Sterling was saying that we're provoking the children and was concerned about their security. You know, why wasn't anyone concerned about their security before this happened? You know, there's no community center up here for these children, so I would like to try to get a community center up here for them and for them to embrace us, because we're not the agitators. You know, the police are. And if we don't stick together and come with a plan, this is going to happen again. You know, 9 months ago, it was Chantel Davis. So obviously, the community needs help. You know, this is not only a Flatbush thing. You know, police brutality affects everyone in New York City and nationwide.
What has changed in the relationship with Councilmember Williams? Have you had a chance to talk through?
I talked to him. And I'm gonna be straightforward because I don't sugarcoat anything. I don't just tend to be lying and protect people's feelings. I'm not protecting anyone's feelings, and I'm gonna talk and be honestly. You know, he doesn't want to stand by us because we're using certain chants he feels that can provoke the children. And he's a councilman, and he can't be around certain things. You know, and I say that, you know, when you're protesting and when you're speaking, it shouldn't be scripted, because people sense out fake for real, and the kids don't want to be around people that's sugarcoating or it's a limit to what you can say. It's not a limit what I can say. If I want to say Father Ray Kelly, I'm going to say it. You can't tell nobody how to respond and behave. You know, I'm not promoting any type of violence. You know, I'm promoting what God gave you to use, and that's your voice. You know, God gave you eyes to see what's wrong. And I believe if we use our voices, we can be heard, but it should be a limit on your voice.
Jose, what do you think of the situation and the communication between us and local politicians here right now at this moment?
Well, to be honest, there's never going to be any real communication or real clear understanding among the politicians and the activists, because the simple fact is they have limitation on how far they could go. We don't have that limitation. You know,
there's a way politicians have to behave and there's a way activists have to behave.
Right. So in other words, they're more advocates than activists, because activists are more, you know, saying in the street and saying what's on their mind. Advocates are more careful with what they say and try to, like she said, script the things they're going to say. But what's important is that groups that have been coming out here from Occupy Wall Street, who, you know what I'm saying, I've been, you know, straggling along with Occupy Wall Street since they started.
Right.
And been part of it since it started, and been, you know, participating as much as I can in a lot of group meetings. I always invited them to come to the hood,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, at the beginning was hard, but now we're starting to realize that we have to spread, you know, this movement that, you know, from Occupy Wall Street to Occupy Sandy, to Occupy these Flatboys. We need to connect all these things, because it deals with the corporation greed, it deals with the policy that these elite teams are putting together that is affecting us. So now we're connecting. So when I call on them, they came and they supported the community. And
that's
people,
a difference than a year and a half ago?
Oh, it's a big difference. Yeah,
talk
it's
about
a difference.
That.
Because, I mean, you know, like I said, I love Occupy Wall Street and everything they did. But there's time, like, you know, I mean, they participated in the Ramali Graham. They participated in the Ronaldo Quill. I can't say they haven't participated, but now, now there is more coming out, you know, with Strike Depp, you know what I'm saying, helping us out to push for the event that we had on Sunday, and Occupy Wall Street and other Occupy groups. We was able to make something that, you know, that people was able to see us say, wow, this is what we need to do. This is what we need to understand, that if we unify, we could create a voice that is so loud and precise that it can't be ignored.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of Strike Debt, what we did last week leading up to the march was a number of us from Strike Debt joined together in a Google group and put together a statement of solidarity for the march on Sunday. And we came up with a really pretty deep analysis of the situation, looking at it through the perspective that Strike Debt would, which is
share that, you know, with us.
Well, I mean, we're continuing to work on a document now to analyze the situation of neoliberalism relative to what's happening out in communities.
So Strike Debt
like this
addresses the issue of money, debt, and power.
Yeah, money,
and
debt,
and
power.
We certainly have a display of power here. Do you want to talk about how money and debt are connected to what's going on here?
Well, I mean, that's sort of a deep question. That's a big question. But, I mean, what I would say in regards to that, just off the top of my head, is that, you know, we're up against the NYPD here and their blue wall. And the NYPD is the vanguard of the banks. They're the protectors of the banks, and they're doing everything they can to keep – there's an investment to keep these communities under their thumb and to keep them in debt, in severe debt. And to make it really difficult, there are no jobs here. When you hear some elements around this issue talking about the kids being bad, and maybe you need to look at the kids and why are the kids perpetrating violence upon themselves
and who's making
the
kids misbehave?
And who's making the kids misbehave? I mean, what they're missing out on is a much deeper analysis of the system beneath these communities, a system that's creating the environment in which is really not much choice for these youths. And the police are protecting that very system that's creating an environment in which these youths have very little choice in what they do with their lives in a large sense, particularly around finances and like that. So we're looking at some analysis into that. We'd like to do it in a way that is understandable, is relevant, and is also, you know, taking into account the history of these communities as well. So we're doing some work on that now, and we're in the midst of putting that together.
I wanted to piggyback on what you were saying, too, dealing with the financial part of this. We have to understand that there's a lot of private prisons being built, all right? and you know, Correction Corporation of America, who is behind this, sent a letter to 54 states letting them know that they could save them money, you know, if they get rid, you know, they get rid of these prisons and let them be the ones taking care of prisoners. So it's a big money thing going on, especially, you know what I'm saying, dealing with, you know, the immigration and dealing with people of color. That's why the prison population is so high, which is close, you know, 3.5 million.
Right. I mean, prisons are becoming privatized. They're becoming corporations in and of themselves. A corporation needs a product and they need workers.
Right.
So the workers are the prisoners. They need to, since more institutions are becoming privatized, they need workers. And those workers are the people who are arrested and incarcerated. They're looking into these communities to bring those prisoners in as workers into that prison industrial complex. And one last thing is, you have to look at stop and frisk, which Jose is an expert on in that regard, because stop and frisk is one of the gateways, not to mention the school grounds now, even junior high school and elementary schools being the gateway to that prison industrial complex as well. And this neighborhood is one of the biggest gateways to that. If you look on the map of precincts of Brooklyn, this precinct has the second highest crime rate, but it has a bunch of police. So does that make sense that there's so many police out there, yet the crime rate is so high? It leads me to believe that maybe there's an investment by that very police department in having...
Where there is police, there is crime. So this neighborhood has experienced this. Jose, you know this. This has been going on for a long time. Forever. Is there anything different that you feel already in response to the resources that are coming? Is there a reason to hope that this is a crack in what is possible?
Well, I mean, the Kimani movement, what it has done, it has opened a gateway for other people of police brutality to be able to speak through that big sound system, you know, the Kimani movement, because it's being talked about all over the world because of what the bravery of these young kids, what they did, understand, to stand up against a military force that, you know, they're afraid of, to be able to release that fear and say, you know what, we're going to fight back. Was incredible.
Is that something you hadn't seen before in quite that way?
Well, I haven't seen that in a long time. I mean, the last time I probably seen that was when, you know, not seen it but heard about it, was when it happened here in 2000, that the Haitian community rised up and rioted against, you know what I'm saying, the police, you know, brutality. And since then, I really haven't seen it. So, you know, that is becoming such a great event, the Kimani movement, because I'm getting solidarities from Russia, from Mexico, from Puerto Rico, you know, Oakland. I mean, it's all over.
Oakland and Russia.
You know, I mean, I was shocked. Yeah, I was shocked again from Russia because, you know, I was like, wow, what they know about what happened.
I got something from overseas, too. Yeah. That was very crazy to me.
Let me ask you, Fatima and Jose, even before Occupy, you guys were activists. Do you think your experience in Occupy changed anything about what you had to bring here?
Well, I never was with Occupy, but, you know, I love Occupy.
Okay.
Because it's like they're so brave, and they're doing what most people refuse to do. And I love when it was Occupy Wall Street.
You loved them then, and you love them now.
I still love them because they reached out to me, you know, with my problem. It was like, so we support you. We already know who you are. We got you. We don't even care. We don't want no details. We got you. And that was like, well, damn. Like, you know, people really care about what's going on. I love Occupy because it's so diverse. They have black people. They have white people. They have all type of people that have one common goal, is to shut down the system. So I love Occupy. I hope they never stop doing what they're doing. Let's occupy Wall Street. Let's occupy Flatbush. Let's occupy the White House. Let's occupy all the streets.
Yeah.
What, if you had to define the word occupy to somebody who maybe missed the whole thing, when you use that word right now, what does it mean to you?
When I say occupy, it's take over what they think they have already. You know, they think that they have us being quiet and they have the streets. So we're going to occupy it because it's ours. You know, so occupy gets sentimental to me because I think that it's time for us to occupy it. It's about taking back what's ours.
Go ahead, Jose.
Yeah, well, I mean, being around Occupy Wall Street and watching the way they approach the situation, dealing with the 1%, that helped me get a better understanding of how I could approach the situation here in the community of color. And basically, I've been pushing the same tactics that I've seen and learned from what they've been doing. It's basically what I've been pushing when I do the rallies, dealing with, you know, especially taking the street, especially going against traffic, and, you know, a lot of those things. And by me doing that has brought a lot of attention to the issues of police brutality in the community of color, from the Bronx all the way down to Brooklyn, to Manhattan, to Queens, and everywhere that, you know, we've been doing it.
We've just been joined by a familiar face, someone I know from Zuccotti Park. What's your name, sir?
Joshua Weller.
Joshua. So you were very active in the Occupy movement, and now we are here in Flatbush, where I understand you used to live.
Yeah, I grew up here. So my family lived here for 2.5 generations, actually.
Tell us what you wanted to add to this conversation.
Oh, well, you had asked, what does Occupy mean? And Occupy is a verb. It's something you do. No two objects can occupy the same space at the same time. When you occupy something, you displace whatever else was already occupying it. So,
nice.
Occupy is a verb. When we occupy something, we push whatever had been occupying it out of there.
Yeah.
East Flatbush is kind of the neighborhood that New York forgot. It's a very strange place. It doesn't, you know, when you look around, you see the neighborhood is economically, it looks like it's thriving. There's lots of small businesses. There's, you know, there's you know, we're sitting in one right now. There's nothing like this when I lived here.
The right.
Neighborhood had actually improved in a lot of ways in the intervening years since the 70s.
We're sitting in part of Camille's Plaza, her salon.
One of the things I wanted to bring up is that, you know, the cops have made a big issue out of Kamani Gray having had a criminal record. And the thing is, if we had the cops in the 70s that we have today and the police policies in the 70s that we have today, I would have had a criminal record. Everybody I knew would have had a criminal record. There are no recreational facilities in this neighborhood for kids. Absolutely none. East Flatbush and Flatlands have the fewest city services of any neighborhoods in the city of New York. And that's not, you know, that's a fact. There is no subway here. The subway goes around East Flatbush. It does not go through East Flatbush. There is one concrete playground that was at least close to a mile from my house. And what we did for fun was we'd, like, you know, sneak into the basements of apartment buildings, usually by breaking a window or something like that.
That's a criminal activity.
Yes, it is. Burglary. And we'd hang out in the basement pretending we were the crew of the Starship Enterprise exploring the caverns under Talos 4 and stuff like that. Or we'd climb around on garage rooftops playing Spider-Man or Batman or something like that. And that's what we did for fun. And, you know, sometimes the cops were called on us, and we did just kind of disappear real fast, but the cops didn't try real hard to catch us.
And nothing's changed in this neighborhood in that way, that a community center is still not here.
There's no community center. There never has been. In the mid-70s, there was an effort by a whole bunch of single moms to take over a vacant lot on Lenox Road, and we created something called the Adventure Playground, but the city condemned it. It was wonderful fun. It was the most fun I ever had living here with the Adventure Playground. But it was just like a whole bunch of single moms got their boyfriends to build some, like, things for us to climb on and some swings and stuff like that, and filled the whole place with sand. It lasted about 3 months. The city in general doesn't seem to want to let anything ever happen here. I've never been able to make sense of it, but it seems like the city of New York just kind of spits on East Flatbush. They don't even want to think about this place. There has been a subway line planned for Utica Avenue since the late 1920s.
Oh,
my
goodness.
In fact, the Utica Avenue stop on the A train has an entire second station built into it that was supposed to accommodate the Utica Avenue line.
And this is a community, a densely populated community, and it is a train and a bus to get here, walk.
Central Brooklyn, East Flatbush, Brownsville, East New York, Flatbush, and Crown Heights are one of the most densely populated. Brooklyn is one of the most, incidentally, like the second or third most densely populated city on Earth. Okay,
yeah.
And this is one of the most densely populated parts of Brooklyn.
And wherever people live, there are children who need the kinds of things you're describing. Some of our listeners might be surprised to hear that it's been this long without. If you were speaking to our listeners, what would you say they could do to help? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, I'm hoping, this is tentative, but we're hoping to take this beyond East Flatbush in the very near future. We're hoping to start doing marches in other neighborhoods with people from, initially with people from East Flatbush, but with other supporters.
Because there are other neighborhoods very nearby in need and who are also grieving about what's happened here.
Yeah, it's not just neighborhoods nearby that we want to go to. We want to take this to the high-rent districts.
Okay.
Okay. And when we come to your neighborhood, come out and join us, because we need to make this big. This is an election year. We can really force this issue this
year. So what you would say to listeners, it's time to occupy your time.
Yeah, well, it's time to occupy NYPD. NYPD functions as a kind of praetorian guard in New York City. Every mayor who has ever tried to reform NYPD has been a one-term mayor. Okay, whether it was Abe Beame or with the Knapp Commission or Dave Dinkins with the Mullen Commission, every effort to bring NYPD to heel has resulted in the mayor who made that attempt losing the next election.
The only thing I would add to what Josh said in terms of what people can do is not just wait for us to come to their neighborhoods, but also to bring themselves here. As we were talking before, there are no outsiders here. The outsiders, as we perceive it right now, are wearing blue. Mm-hmm. And some of them have white shirts on, but that's the NYPD. And we ask people to come support us every evening at 7 o'clock for the vigil on East 55th Street.
And this is going to go on.